would send thermals of air swirling upward from the ground. Sitting in his little windowless compartment, getting bounced so hard that things would slide off the desk, Zink often felt airsick. But he also felt too busy to get sick. "I'll throw up later," he'd tell himself. "I have too much to do right now." The navigator would be in constant communication with the pilot, warning of the terrain that was approaching. The B-52's navigational tools were rudimentary. Its avionics still relied on vacuum tubes instead of integrated circuits, and data was entered into the bombing computer with IBM punch cards. At low altitudes, the B-52 was an extraordinary sight, a huge plane with a wingspan about 60 yards wide hugging the terrain, casting a long shadow, traveling 7 or 8 miles a minute. Zink's crew often flew through the Rocky Mountains, and the one time that Zink sat in the cockpit, it was fun to watch the pilot bank around hills and drop into alpine valleys. But sitting down below, without any frame of reference other than his radar screen, the experience could be terrifying. On more than one nighttime flight, Zink thought, "We're going to die," as the pilot ignored his warning that a mountain was dead ahead and waited an extra moment to climb. During low-altitude practice runs, Zink's crew would radar bomb targets throughout the American West, hitting SAC radar huts in places like Sheridan, Wyoming, Bismarck, North Dakota, and La Junta, Colorado. And before a training mission ended, the pilot would spend an hour or two doing pattern work, landing the plane, rolling down the runway, and then taking off again. Zink found these touch-and-go landings even harder to endure than heavy turbulence. At the end of every training flight, he felt like someone had just pummeled him for hours. The klaxons sounded about once a week during ground alerts. The drills were supposed to be no notice and come as a total surprise. But by the late 1970s, SAC was taking some precautions. Whenever Zink and his buddies saw three fire trucks and the wing commander's car park on the alert pad, they'd know a drill was about to begin. They'd stand in the tunnel waiting, making bets on how many seconds would pass before the klaxons went off. And then they'd run to their planes. As navigator, Zink would decode the message from SAC headquarters. It usually called for an engine start or a mover, an exercise that involved taxiing the bomber to the end of the runway, turning around, and returning to the alert pad. Once the drills were completed, the crew would spend about 3 hours reconfiguring the plane for the next alert. A few months earlier, during the first week of June, Zink had been fast asleep at about 12:30 in the morning when the klaxons sounded. He jumped out of bed, looked out the window, and didn't see any fire trucks or the wing commander's car. He and the bombardier thought, "Oh my God, it's the real thing." Drills were never held late at night. Hearts pounding, they ran to the plane. Zink decoded the message and felt profoundly relieved that it didn't contain an emergency war order. The whole episode felt strange, and it wasn't until weeks later that they learned NORAD had experienced a false alarm. The gunner on Zink's crew, a young staff sergeant, was so shaken by the experience that he quit the Air Force. All of a sudden, the meaning of their wartime mission had become clear, and he realized, "I can't do this." Zink believed strongly in the value of nuclear deterrence and tried not to dwell on what would happen if deterrence failed. He knew that any attack on the Soviet Union by his crew would be not only murderous but suicidal. And yet he never thought about those things while crawling around the Mark 28s and short-range attack missiles in the bomb bay, checking their serial numbers before an alert. Zink and his crew were expecting the drill on September 15, 1980. It was about 8:30 in the evening, and out the window you could see the fire trucks and the wing commander's car. The klaxons sounded. They ran to the plane. Zink put on his headphones and turned the crew volume low so he could hear the code from SAC headquarters over the radio. "Alpha, Charlie, Delta," he heard, copying each letter down. And then his pilot's voice was shouting over the intercom, "Terminate, terminate, terminate." For some reason, the pilot was ending the drill. Zink felt scared for a moment, wondering why the pilot was yelling. He and the bombardier looked at each other. They couldn't see outside, had no idea what was happening, and then heard a loud bang. Something big had struck the right side of the plane. The lights went out, the cabin became pitch black, and Zink knew it was time to evacuate. The navigator was supposed to open the hatch for the rest of the crew and leave the plane first, but the gunner, who sat upstairs, had already jumped down, landed on the floor, and opened the hatch. And without a word, the gunner leaped through the hatch to the tarmac below. Zink's seat was closest to the hatch, yet four of the five other crew members managed to get out of the plane before him, like rats from a sinking ship. Through the open hatch, Zink could see a bright orange glow. Not a good sign. Zink didn't bother with the ladder. He jumped the 5 feet to the runway, landed in a crouch, saw that the right wing of the bomber was on fire, and ran as fast as he could. Now he understood why the crew was in such a hurry. A B-52 had caught fire on the runway a few weeks earlier at Warner Robins Air Force Base near Macon, Georgia. Within minutes, the plane had exploded, and it literally melted into the ground. But that B-52 hadn't been carrying nuclear weapons. This one was loaded with 8 SRAMs and 4 Mark 28 bombs. Zink ran for about 300 yards, expecting to get knocked down at any second by an explosion. The wing commander's car pulled up beside him. A window rolled down, and the wing commander said, "Get in." Zink was glad to obey that order. He turned around and saw that the plane's number 5 engine was shooting flames like a blowtorch. It was the engine on the right wing closest to the fuselage, and the fire was cascading down the length of the aircraft. The wing commander was calling firemen on the radio, trying to solve the problem, well aware that not only the plane, but his career at SAC might be going up in flames. The nose of the B-52 was pointing toward the southeast, and a wind with gusts of up to 35 miles per hour was blowing in that direction. The wind swept from the tail straight down the fuselage, keeping the fire away from the fuel tanks in the wings and away from the bomb bay. Although the power had been shut off on the plane, gravity continued to feed jet fuel into the number 5 engine. It had become a gigantic flamethrower. Fire trucks sprayed foam on the engine, and yet the steady supply of fuel kept the fire burning. For the moment, the strong wind was pushing the flames away from the B-52. But the wind could change direction.